Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. Hello, I'm Peter Moore. Today we're going to be talking about the bravery and the sacrifice of the International Brigades during the Spanish Civil War. In the 1930s, over 35,000 men and women from 61 different countries travelled to Spain. They travelled to defend democracy against General Franco's army as it attempted to overthrow the young republic. Although inexperienced, poorly trained and ill-equipped, these were young men and women driven by a simple desire to do the right thing. They placed themselves in the firing line against the combined forces of Hitler, Mussolini and Franco. They fought side by side with a makeshift Republican army that had been abandoned by the Allies to its fate. This was a war made famous by witnesses such as Hemingway, Laurie Lee and George Orwell, the first war to be brought vividly into people's homes by the photographic journalism of Robert Capa. For many, those years in Spain were remembered as a kaleidoscopic mix of love, sex, war, and revolution. But for others, it was a place of terror, torture, and death. For all those who fought in it, it would become the defining moment of their lives. In his compelling new narrative history of the International Brigades, the Elizabeth Longford Prize-winning historian and journalist Giles Tremlett takes us deep into the heart of 1930s Spain. This is a country divided between anarchists, communists and socialists on the one side and reactionary generals, landowners and priests on the other. Here is Giles taking our very own John Hillman on a travel back through time.
Giles, welcome to Travels Through Time.
Thank you very much for having me, and greetings from Madrid, Spain.
Lovely. Well, I hear the weather's a bit better than it is in around the UK at the moment. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. Giles, you are a contributing editor to The Guardian. You've lived in and written about Spain for over 20 years now. You are the author of Catherine of Aragon, Ghost of Spain, and Isabella of Castile, winner of the 2018 Elizabeth Longford Prize. And your latest work, The International Brigades, Fascism, Freedom and the Spanish Civil War, was described as a magnificent narrative history at its vivid and compelling best by Fergal Keane, which is a lovely compliment. What actually draws you to writing about the history of Spain in particular?
Well, I live in Spain, and you know, I started off as a journalist here many, many years ago. I am actually Spanish now, too. So a few weeks ago, I took Spanish nationality. So this is my world, and this is where I live, and this is what I've been writing about for 20, 25 years now.
You've jumped from, you've moved quite forward with this new book, haven't you, to a much more recent history. I want to ask what it was that drew you to the story of the International Brigades in particular, really, because it's a really fascinating part of history.
Yes, well, I've always been fascinated by the International Brigades and by the Spanish Civil War, but the brigades especially, because they were such a unique phenomenon at the time. You know, when people, there's these 35,000 volunteers from around the world, they come from more than 80 of today's countries. And at the time, in the 1936, in the late 30s, people struggled to find something to compare them with when they look back over history. Eventually, it was the Crusades, and the Crusaders were the only kind of comparison that they could find for something quite as multinational and volunteer. And it was a very unique thing, all these idealists turning up prepared to give their lives, as many of them did. 20% of them died here for an idea, or the defense of a democracy. And we can go into to what extent they were defending democracy and to what extent they were fighting a sort of world war, which was about to start. And many people see the Spanish Civil War as the opening salvo, or the curtain raiser of the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you raise that point, because I think particularly, I spent some time in Spain, and I've often thought that Spanish history is often mistold, slightly misunderstood in many ways, almost a kind of story of decline. And you know, growing up, you were often told that, or you're often led to believe that Spain kind of sat out World War II, really, or sat out the Second World War. But I think what this book does really well is it really places Spain in that kind of context of being at the very start of that pan-European struggle against fascism, really, that kind of resistance to fascism. And, you know, it's where the Soviet Union first confronts Hitler. It's where the Luftwaffe begin sort of honing their tactics and their techniques. And I think it really places Spain much more at the centre of global affairs than many people would give it credit for.
No, totally. I mean, in a way, I mean, you can look at Spain as the sort of the first victim, if you want, of the age of extremes, when the great ideologies of the 20th century, you know, finally begin to clash, and the first real clash is here. On the one side, you very definitely have not just Franco, who's not a fully fledged fascist, but he's very close to it. But you definitely have both Hitler and Mussolini sending their troops, especially their air forces, who made a huge difference to the outcome of the Spanish Civil War. And then on the other side, you have basically a counter revolution to begin with. As soon as General Franco and his generals rise up against the Republican democracy, a revolution happens on the other side. That Spain is full of anarchists and communists, more socialists actually than communists, and so we get a sort of a reaction. It sparks something else on the other side, and then you know, Stalin comes to the aid of the Republic. Britain, France, all the democracies decide to sit it out. They propose and follow a process of non-intervention, which really is the beginning of appeasement. Hitler and Mussolini sign up to this, you know, a non-intervention agreement, but totally ignore it and send over regular troops, regular air force units. And Britain and the rest of the democratic world won't even let people go and volunteer to fight, so the volunteers who come often have to do so clandestinely now.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big sort of themes, really, isn't it? This non-intervention, you know, is completely ignored by the Axis powers and followed to the letter by the Allies, and that seems to have a big impact on the outcome.
It does. Well, it has a huge impact on the outcome. I mean, In the purely military sense, because Franco's air force is two-thirds made up of Italians and Germans, with their aircraft paid for by Mussolini and Hitler, their regular air force units, so the Condor Legion from Germany, and Mussolini actually sends about 75,000 troops plus air units. And they really just make a huge difference. Blitzkrieg is really not invented, but is practiced and honed in Spain. The Republic, which I think could have expected support from other democracies, doesn't get it. Has to turn to Stalin for help. He's sort of interested, but not that interested, and helps up to a certain degree. And really the volunteers, the international brigade, are sort of trying to fill that gap. There's a void there where the democracies aren't doing anything. Stalin's sending some help, but not enough. And these, you know, 35,000 individuals volunteer to go and fight in somewhere that they probably know very little about. Where they don't speak the language, where they're going to fight alongside people who speak two or three dozen other languages in this sort of rather remarkable outfit, where, for example, for the first time you have black American officers commanding white American troops, something that was impossible in the American army and would remain impossible during World War II. So it's a remarkable moment, and especially for them, you know, in their later lives, you find that this is the big moment of their lives. You know, they can never quite forget their experience in Spain.
No, I don't think you could you really forget an experience like that? I mean, well, look, should we just dive straight in then? So we start by asking all our guests this question, really. If you could travel back in time, what year would you like to visit?
Well, if I could travel back in time, I would visit 1936.
Right.
And I would visit it here in Spain. To give some context, earlier in the year, Spain's democracy has, the people in charge have changed hands. There's been elections. The left has come into power, a sort of broad left popular front coalition, very similar to the one that was running France at the same time. Mm-hmm. Spain has a very young democracy. It had only been founded properly in 1932 when they'd thrown out the monarchy. It's been a fairly rough ride up to then, but they managed to start with a left-wing government, then go to a right-wing government, and now they're back to a left-wing government. There's a sort of reactionary establishment basically made up of the church, the army, mm-hmm. and the landowners, and they're very scared of the left wing, especially the anarchist and the communist and the sort of stronger socialist side of this left wing coalition, mm-hmm. and they decide that they're going to have a coup.
Wow, so this is the year that, I mean, you know, I suppose we can jump to your first scene, and that would be a good time to sort of talk about how the civil war breaks out, I suppose. So yeah, what's the first scene you'd like to visit?
Okay, so the first scene, we're in Barcelona. It's July the 19th, 1936. The city is very excited because this is the day where the popular Olympics, the Olympiad Popular, mm-hmm. is meant to start, and that's a rival to Hitler's games, Olympic Games, which are coming up in August.
Right.
And it's a sort of fraternal left wing sporting event. With teams arriving from all over Europe and from the United States mm-hmm. as well, where the posters are very deliberately showing the faces of people of different colours and different races, and it's meant to be this celebration of sort of left-wing internationalism mm. and sort of a friendly sporting event. And all these teams have arrived. It's specifically asked the Americans to make sure that they send black athletes over as well.
Right.
So there are several of them. There are teams from, there's actually a team of Jews, there's a team of Algerians. You know, these are countries which don't exist at the time. Mm. And the Catalans also have their team. And so there's this great event is meant to start. Pau Gasols, the great cellist, is practicing with his orchestra.
Right,
they're
yes.
meant to be playing the Ode to Joy as there's in the opening ceremony. But what happens? The coup happens. There's a military yeah. uprising. It started the day before, in fact, in the north of Africa, which is where Franco's Army of Africa is based, where he's based with what's really the strongest part of the army. Mm-hmm. And so in the cities around Spain, on the 19th of July, the coup starts. And it starts in Barcelona. In mm-hmm. fact, a day before, it starts in Madrid. And that mm-hmm. morning, basically, the tanks... They're very tiny tanks at that stage, I
right.
have to say, but also the artillery and the soldiers come out of the barracks around Barcelona and start marching into the city. But, you know, Barcelona has been a bit of a tinderbox for quite
yeah.
a while, and people are really expecting something to happen. And also Barcelona is this sort of remarkable place at the time in political terms because... Spain is the capital of anarchism, Barcelona right. is the capital of Spanish anarchism, and so uh-huh. there's this immensely strong anarchist union, the CNT, mm-hmm. The socialists are powerful, but there's also a Catalan regional government which would be opposed to a coup, mm-hmm. and so all these sort of forces gel and oppose the coup, and there's this sort of dramatic day of fighting in Barcelona, where lots of foreigners staying in the city because of the games, or because they already live there, and some of them start to join in, or join the militia groups, and that's sort of in a way the beginning of the story of the volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story. I mean, first off, you've got this sporting event, which I think for modern listeners, the idea that you'd have a sporting event affiliated with kind of political ideology in modern times, that's really unusual, isn't it? Because, I mean, sporting events nowadays are such commercial affairs, and it's, you know, and then you have this, the fighting when it breaks out. I think you describe you bring some great characters in. I mean, the sense that you get from it is, I mean, particularly having all these young, you know, politically aware athletes there too, and a lot of them just get caught up in this moment, don't they? I mean, a lot of them don't want to leave. I mean, one of my favorites was Nat Cohen, who I made a note of, who cycled down from the East End with a slogan, "We have nothing to lose but our chains," from the Clarion Cycling Club, which I thought was brilliant. That's a very British, that I never miss an opportunity for a pun.
Well, the Clarion Cycling Club, I think, still exists in London, so yes, that's a wonderful thing. But what we're actually seeing those first few days is a sort of proto or pre-international brigade thing. So we actually have this sort of, it's a spontaneous desire to go and help. And often, you know, historians have often looked at the brigades because they're actually formed much later in October.
Right.
And they're formed by Comintern, by the Communist International. And so they're often seen through that lens as if they're somehow organized by Moscow, and they're simply in Stalin's tool. And I don't see it like that at all. In fact, I'm changing their title. It was actually the last history of the International Brigades before my book was in English anyway. It was in the 1980s. It was actually called Comintern Army. By an American, Vernon Rogers. So you know, I've rather changed the perspective on that, because I do see that there's a popular desire, which is, you know, which preempts the brigades themselves. So these two things sort of happen.
Yeah, definitely brings them, people from all over Europe, really coming, and all over the world indeed, spontaneously travelling to Spain to take a stand, really. And I suppose that could bring us quite neatly onto our second scene, couldn't it? Let's go. Where are we going next then?
So we were in Barcelona in July, July the 19th. That's when the coup, the attempt to topple Spanish democracy, has happened. But essentially what happens after that is that it fails. A coup should take place over a couple of days. You grab ministries and radio stations and proclaim yourself in charge. And it either works or it doesn't. But in fact, what happens in Spain is something very different. A war breaks out. The coup doesn't fail. That doesn't work, but doesn't fail completely either. Hitler plays an important part in this, because he ships over the Army of Africa, which is based in North Africa, in Morocco, in the Spanish territories there.
So this is a professional army, isn't it?
Army, and it's the only real fighting force in Spain. And the Republic doesn't really have an army, because the army has gone over to the other side. So it's a bunch of poorly trained, poorly organized militia units that sort of think that, you know, you fight from 9 to 5 and then you go home, well, not from 9 to 5, but, you know, during the day, and then you go home to bed, and then you start again the following day. And so we're going to go instead to Paris on October the 10th to the railway station, the Quai d'Orsay, which is where the first train load of organized volunteers of the International Brigades are gathering. This train becomes known over time as the Red Express, because it's this sort of regular delivery of volunteers from around the world who generally gather first in Paris and then are moved to Spain. And amongst them is a British poet, John Cornford, with him a communist writer called John Summerfield, and they form a little group. There's another Cambridge friend of Cornford's called Bernard Knox. He's just finished his classics degree. There's a painter, German exile painter called Jan Kurtzke, and they form this little group who actually have been they've been recruited by John Cornford, who had been to Spain before, gone back, recruited a bunch of people, And they didn't even know that the international brigades existed at this stage. They were right. just going to Spain to fight. And they get to the station and suddenly they can see there are lots of other groups of young men like them sort of standing around, sort of pretending that they have nothing to do with one another. And they are slightly, they think this is all a bit strange. And then suddenly the train arrives and suddenly everybody gets on the train and they realize that they're all going to do the same thing, that they're all volunteers. I'd say most of the others know that they're going to join the international brigades. They have been sort of properly recruited through these recruitment offices that the Comintern starts to run.
So this is the Soviets actually organizing this.
Well, it's not really the Soviets, because Comintern is the Communist International, so it's right. all the communist parties of Europe, of the mm-hmm. world. It's their sort of club, it's their organization, and their main office is in Moscow.
Right.
So, to a certain degree, yes, they're controlled by Moscow, but not absolutely. And certainly at the time, for lots of the communists who are members of different parties, they don't have the feeling that their parties are controlled from Moscow yet.
Right.
They're about to get a rude awakening, mm-hmm. Not necessarily in Spain, but you know, events over the next few years mm-hmm. are about to prove that actually they're wrong. Mm-hmm. But from the sort of base level of the volunteers, who I've talked about poets and painters mm-hmm. and Cambridge graduates, but most of them are 95% of them are working men, almost all of them men, some women, mm-hmm. And they think and they are part of their national communist parties, those who are communists, which is about half the volunteers, and the other half aren't. The other half are just people who want to go and fight, defend Spanish democracy. And the international brigades become sort of structure that they're allowed to join. And in fact, the international brigades themselves are organized in the spirit of the popular front, which Comintern actually has sort of come to embrace two years before, the idea that they should be supporting popular front governments around right. Around Europe. So this is the spirit of these men as they get onto the train. Some of them are ardent communists, others of them aren't, but they feel very strongly that they have to go and defend Spain against what to them they see as a fascist aggression. Remember, Hitler's already there, Mussolini's already there, and they feel, this is a chance to fight back against this growing thing, which is fascism.
I think you mentioned that, don't you? It says that the main qualification for carrying out this task in a foreign land was the simple idealistic conviction that they're doing the right thing. And I think that's makes it such a unique group of people. But you talk about the British volunteers. They're quite different to the rest, aren't they? They
certainly are in this group, and partly because actually the British, the sort of organised British recruitment to the international brigades doesn't happen for several months. So Cornford and co really sort of belong to the sort of the more spontaneous part of the international brigades rather than the organised mm-hmm. part. So we don't actually have a British brigade in Spain until February. What we do have is we have lots of French, lots of Belgians, mm-hmm. lots of Germans, especially exiles, mm-hmm. lots of Italian exiles, lots of Polish exiles, Hungarians, wherever. Across Europe, there's an authoritarian or fascist government. Paris, especially, is full of political exiles. But right. also, the brigades act as a sort of magnet to them. This is their chance to actually do something.
And a lot of them had been persecuted at home, had they? I think a lot of them,
A lot of them have either escaped jail, or they've been in prison, or they've been in trouble in their own countries. And then there's a sort of second category of exiles who are just economic exiles. But because they're the sort of bottom of the heap immigrants, they're more likely also to be left wing or to be radicalized. Yeah. And so they're also make up a large part of the international brigade. So I tend to call it, I call them the devout and the displaced.
Right.
The devout in the political sense and the displaced in the sort of migrant sense. And that covers actually a surprisingly large percentage of the brigaders.
And they all make their way to Spain. So the Red Express, it must have been quite a quite a journey, really, to quite an atmosphere. Yeah,
really, everybody found that particular journey unforgettable. For several reasons. One is just to be traveling with all these people who are all going to do the same thing, but who all speak different languages. It's a sort of a Tower of Babel on wheels as it clanks its way south. And there's this moment where the only thing that they have in common, they're all singing their songs, the German songs, the English songs, the Polish songs, and suddenly there's one song that they all know. They have different words for them in their own language, but it's the Internationale.
Right.
And so there's this sort of a moment that makes the sort of goosebumps come out on everybody's body, where suddenly they find there's this one thing they can all do, which is sing the same song. And this is sort of, people remember that very strongly as well.
Do you think they were aware of what they were heading into at that point? I mean,
I don't think they were aware. Most of them had never held a weapon before. Many of them had been sort of ardent pacifists in the sort of anti-imperialist sense, where they'd seen World War One go by, seen how vast numbers of people had been slaughtered, often working men had been slaughtered for, they weren't really sure, for national glory or whatever. And there was this sort of very strong anti-war feeling, which is suddenly flipped. And and so they have no training, unless they're older and have actually been in World War One. And in fact, they're about to go to Spain nominally to be trained and equipped to fight. But there's such chaos in Spain that they barely get any training. And I have to say, some of them don't really want any training because they think that's a sort of slightly bourgeois sort of thing to do, go around marching and obeying orders.
Yeah.
And so, they have very little training and are thrown into the thick of it rather quickly.
Hi, I'm Artemis, one of the presenters on this podcast. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. Through his expertly researched and detailed work, Jordan has brought to life some of the most famous events and people from modern history. Whether it's his portrait of Abraham Lincoln or his sweeping panorama of the D-Day beaches in 1944. One of my current favourites is a photograph taken on the 1911 Terra Nova expedition to the Antarctic. The original shot is strange and beautiful, and it shows just how otherworldly parts of our planet can sometimes look. But the image is completely elevated by the deep and icy blues that Jordan's colourisation work brings out. This, alongside many others, are available to buy as prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colourgraph.co.
Well, actually, that will bring us on really nicely to our next scene, I believe. Shall we pause it there and go on to our next destination, if you'd like to tell us where that is?
Okay, so our next destination is Madrid, the capital of Spain. We're going to go on a month to November the 8th in 1936. We've seen just the previous, just 4 weeks earlier, the first volunteers of the International Brigades getting on their trains in Paris, traveling to Spain, but they're also coming, some people are arriving by boat, some people have cycled. Anyway, this mass of people have appeared, and they've gone to a city called Albacete, train nominally, which we've just spoken about, which was really virtually no training at all.
Right. Yeah.
With weapons given to them at the very last minute, and the hope had been that they would spend a couple of months training, but no, there's a massive crisis in Madrid. Franco's troops, the Army of Africa, has swept up from the south, and it's at the gates of Madrid, and suddenly they're called into Madrid, and we have this moment where on the Gran Via, which is sort of Madrid's Oxford Street, people from Madrid suddenly look out, and there's this sort of marching unit of men marching up their street, and they're not really used to this because the Republican Army doesn't really march because that's bourgeois. and also these, who are these people? They're tall, they're blonde, they seem to speak other languages. People start, but they're obviously coming to help them, and people start shouting, Viva Russia, you know, long live Russia. They think the Russians have finally come to save them. You know, even the government has left Madrid by this stage, convinced that, you know, the city's about to fall. And and there's a very nice scene described by Jeffrey Cox, a New Zealand journalist, who sort of tumbles out of his hotel on the Gran Via and watches them sort of tramping up Gran Via, and this sort of sensation that something serious is happening, that there's this serious fighting force has just turned up, and all these commands being barked out in German and Italian and French.
And they the people were abandoned at this point. Well, I mean, that's important to add here, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned that the Prime Minister, Largo Caballero, he'd left, his government had left, everybody had kind of abandoned the city. The people they'd been told that when Franco had taken, I'm not sure where it was, but they were expecting mass shootings. It must have been terrifying for the actual residents of Madrid. And then to suddenly see these people marching up the street to defend them, I can't imagine what that must have felt like, really.
Yes, I mean, you know, there were, you know, a crowd emerged to greet them, but there was this, and the brigaders themselves sensed it as they marched up the street. They said they sort of felt as if they were kind of marching into a very gloomy place where people were already resigned to the fact that they, you know, that the city was about to be overrun, and they'd already seen what had happened in other cities where Franco's troops had gone in to, say, Badajoz, where there'd been this massive sort of shooting of left wingers or people that they simply didn't like in the bull ring. And so there was a lot of fear and resignation. The idea that, you know, well, the government's gone, they don't even believe that the city can hold out. And yet here is the International Brigade marching up the street. It's going all the way through the center of Madrid up to the university city, which was then on the outskirts of Madrid. It was this brand new university campus. It hadn't even been occupied at the time by students. And they marched up there to start organizing a defense of the city, sort of around the perimeter of the university campus and along the river.
And this becomes the front line of defense, doesn't it? This is where the battle takes place, really. The university city is where it all...
Yes, the university city and the Casa de Campo, which is a big park that sort of comes up against it, borders it. This is where the fighting is going to happen. Franco's troops are making their way through the park, so they know that they're going to clash at some point. But everything's pretty chaotic and nobody really knows where anybody else is. And the defense of the city itself, they've only just discovered what the Francoist plans are. Fortunately, they'd captured an officer 2 days earlier.
It was a real stroke of luck.
Was a total stroke of luck, who actually had the plans on him. And so they knew which bit of the city was going to be attacked. And so the brigaders were there, and in fact, the very next day, the first of Franco's troops tried to cross the river Manzanares, which it sounds like a sort of huge river going through Madrid. It's not really very big. You can wade through it sort of with the water up to your knees, basically. and they come across the river, and they're in the city. And that's when... they come across the International Brigades for the first time. The International Brigades also, you know, have their first experience of fighting. Right. And it's a group of Hungarians who meet them, and they do what every new International Brigades unit will do during the rest of the war, which is immediately run straight into blazing guns and die, basically. Yeah. But in this case, it works, and they see them off.
Yeah, I mean, were they expecting? They weren't expecting the International Brigades, were they? I wonder what they must have thought. The Franco's forces to suddenly.
Well, indeed. I mean, they'd had a sort of a bit of a cakewalk up to then against sort of these sort of scattered militia units, which weren't very well organised and certainly weren't as motivated as the brigaders were. And it was a very important part of their sort of their ability to fight was actually the idea that they wanted to, that they thought they were doing something valuable, and this was very, very important. Unfortunately, it also made them, you know, very easy to kill because they exposed themselves far too much, and sort of thought that ideology was sort of enough to protect.
Yeah, I mean, the casualty rates were very high, weren't they? Throughout, really. But I mean, I think it's important to say at this moment, I guess, that they acquitted themselves very well, didn't they? Although they lost a lot of, they had a lot of casualties, but actually they kind of worked, didn't they? They halted
They did. Well, they were part of the sort of broader action which finally brought Franco's, you know, advance to a halt on the outside of Madrid. And this was an advance which had been going on for months. Franco's troops a few days later actually get into the university city when the International Brigades, at this stage it's only one brigade of the six that will be eventually formed and moved to another part of the front, and then suddenly have to be called back to try and contain Franco's troops there. And then a second International Brigade, which has just been formed, that has even less training, is sent in to help. And they basically hold about a third of that line. And so between them and the sort of the people in Madrid, the Madrid units who begin to fight well as well, they put a halt to the advance. But then, of course, the brigades are very good at doing propaganda, and there's this feeling, certainly in the rest of the world, that it was them who stopped the Francoist advance, and it's partially true, but it's not completely true. But they certainly become the heroes of Madrid in the international sense, and also in Madrid itself, because people are just so pleased, you know, by these people who've appeared from nowhere. Cornford and company end up in the philosophy faculty manning a machine gun, and they have to build these sort of parapets. And the only thing they can use are these... the books that are on the shelves in the philosophy faculty, and so they end up sort of picking out the weightier tomes, which are sort of 19th century German philosophy or Indian metaphysics, and they discover that, you know, that enemy bullets can't get past page 350. Yeah,
it's good knowledge.
Exactly. exhausted by the effort and the density of whatever's inside them.
And so this first encounter, really, between the International Brigades and Franco's forces, they do come off quite well, although they suffer quite a lot.
They come off very well indeed. Specifically, they come off very well because they're such poorly trained soldiers. And to, you know, to perform so well against very well trained and well equipped soldiers was, I think, pretty remarkable.
That's an amazing story, and I think just kind of one of the things I found really interesting was how the international brigades, although they obviously we all know that, you know, Franco he actually won and you know, Spain he was a dictator until the mid 1970s, but what happened with the international brigades after the Civil War is very interesting, and the effect they had on the wider resistance movement in Europe. I was wondering if you could just touch upon that quite briefly, because it was something that I wasn't aware of.
Yes, well, actually, it was something I wasn't aware of either, and it was one of the sort of more pleasant, you know, finds as I researched. And it actually makes sense when you think about it. That here were, you know, 20,000 odd people left over, or 15,000 in conditions to fight, whose countries were mostly invaded, and they ended up forming resistance units. They were very important in the French resistance. Of course, there's also an afterlife, which is just as fascinating, because lots of the brigaders are communists, and behind the Iron Curtain, in the Soviet-controlled part of Europe, the Soviets turn to them because they trust them, because these are people who actually fought against Hitler, for example, in Germany, so they've become very powerful, important in East Germany, in Yugoslavia as well. There's a time where I don't know exactly how many foreign ministers in the Iron Curtain are ex-brigaders, but they sort of seem to form a club. And there's 39 generals in the Yugoslav army. And then we get the sort of sad part of the tale, which is where some of them become basically Stalin's tools, oppressors in communist regimes. And they're the sort of the worst stories through the Stasi in East Germany, which in fact is founded by a brigader and then is run by another brigader for almost 30 years. So that sort of, you know, takes a bit of a shine off the story. And that's another amazing thing about the Spanish War, actually, is just how many of these sort of great future characters are kind of attracted to it.
It's so much. So, yeah. And I mean, just we haven't really touched on it either, but I mean, you've got, you know, this is like the beginning of photojournalism as well, isn't it? With there's so much.
And Taro and
Yeah, we could talk all day, really. it's such a fascinating...
Well, you can. I mean, you can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
But I promise not to.
Yeah, brilliant.
Ted Heath turns up.
Wow, Ted Heath. Wow, blimey. Didn't know that.
Ted Heath turns up because he's a fan of the International Brigades.
Ah.
And this is really strange because in the International Brigades is Jack Jones, the future head of the Transport General Workers
That's
Union,
right, yes,
who
yeah.
lead all the strikes against Ted Heath.
Wow.
And then also, you know, there's actually Sir Alfred Sherman, who's going to go on to become Margaret Thatcher's, you know, free markets guru, even though he's a communist at the time.
It's fantastic.
Well, it was the centre of global politics. It was, you know, it was the it was where everything was beginning to play out, and that's why everybody was watching it so closely, and that's why it was so important, and that's why the volunteers were attracted to it. And it really is, you know, it's a very, very important event in European history.
Hugely.
Too often looked at just as a sort of Spanish thing, but no, it was really part of the much wider march of this sort of titanic clash of ideologies.
Absolutely. And I think your book does a really good job of bringing that to life. It really does bring that whole, in, you know, places it where it should be in terms of the context internationally. And I think it's been a really fascinating read. And I must ask before we end, we always ask our guests if they can bring a memento back with them from the period. And what have you selected?
Well, I've chosen a memento which I found in the Tamament Library in New York, New York University's library, which is the sort of the sports jacket that the U.S. team to the People's Olympiad to the popular Olympiad in Barcelona wore. Which never happened, of course, but you know, the team made it there, and they had their outfit, and this is sort of pure 1930s sort of college vintage style.
Oh, it's quite big, cool then, I imagine.
Totally, with a sort of big USA on the back, and it's sort of, you know, shaped like a bit like a bomber jacket. You know, you can imagine those; they haven't actually changed that much over time. Those American sort of sports jackets.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful thing to suddenly open, you know, and it's sort of conserved in nice paper in a box, and to open it out and think, gosh, you know, somebody actually wore this and they took it to Barcelona, and actually represents this sort of desire to have this sort of fraternal, if you want, Olympic games, which is not going to be like Hitler's games, which are just this massive propaganda exercise that's just about to come up, and what that means in terms of, you know, the clash that's about to happen, and also in terms of the volunteers, because some of those sportsmen and women will end up joining the brigades. We haven't talked about the women, I'm afraid, partly because they don't go onto the front line, but there were about 700, 800 women who joined the brigades, mostly as doctors and nurses.
And they stayed a lot longer, didn't they? I think.
Well, they stayed a lot longer because they didn't get wounded or killed. You know, they weren't generally on the front line, but they also lived it very, very intensely.
Mm.
And there are sort of wonderful stories of love affairs, which are sort of remarkably short, because, you know, they fall in love with one of their patients who goes back to the front line and then is killed. But it's all part of the intensity of the moment.
That intense moment, I think I can't remember you describing it as It's a moment in your around the People's Olympiad, where you describe it as a kaleidoscopic mix of love, sex, war, and revolution, which I think is
indeed
a very nice line.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, thanks so much for coming on. As I said, I've really, really enjoyed the International Brigade. One of the great stories of the 20th century, really, I believe. And, you know, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about it. And, yeah, thank you. As I say, it's out on Bloomsbury, the International Brigade's Fascism, Freedom and the Spanish Civil War.
Hey, thank you thank very you. Much indeed.
That was Giles Tremlett taking John Hillman back to the year 1936. For much, much more, do check out his book, The International Brigades, Fascism, Freedom and the Spanish Civil War. It's recently been published in hardback by Bloomsbury. To find out more about this episode, do head to our website, which is tttpodcast.com. We've also just started up a little Travels Through Time Facebook page too, where we will be posting little snippets about past, present and future episodes. But for today and this episode, that's it. A small note of historical importance. This is, of course, the 3rd of November 2020. I wonder how in years to come people will remember today's date. We'll just have to wait and see. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.